From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm producer Megan Mack. We have a lot to share with you from a packed week on the show, so let's open our podcast with the interview that opened the week. We welcome the investigative journalist who broke the Flint water crisis story to the show.
His name is Kurt Guyette. He's got an unusual background. He was a journalist at a daily newspaper in Michigan for nearly 30 years. Then he took a job as an investigative reporter for the ACLU. And that might make you pause. Did you know the ACLU has investigative reporters? I did not. Well, this is the only such position in the country. And in that position, Guyette started digging on the health problems that people in Flint were having after local leaders switched the water supply.
Guyette came to Rochester to visit with journalism students. Here he is on Connections talking about how he obtained a memo from the EPA that showed the government's lead tests were essentially faked.
Because we took their concerns seriously and didn't blow them off, Leanne gave that memo to us. We published it in July 9th of 2015 and tried to get comment from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. They blew me off. They just would not respond. Subsequent emails showed that them talking about it, saying, oh, this reporter from the ACLU keeps calling. And they put the word reporter in quotes because I work for an advocacy organization. They didn't consider me a legitimate reporter. Although, you know, it's not their job to only respond to reporters. They're supposed to serve the public in general. So there was no legitimate reason for them not to answer my questions, whether I was a reporter or not. But they chose not to. But very quickly after that, Michigan Radio, which is a public radio network in Michigan, picked up on the story and did follow up on it. And the spokesman for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, former spokesman now, a guy named Brad Werfel, said, when it comes to lead in their water, the people of Flint should just relax. And that was his word, relax. There's no overall problem with Flint, the lead in Flint's water, because we've been conducting tests all throughout the city, and our tests show that there's not a problem.
And that couldn't have been true, right?
Well, the science indicated that it probably was not true, but that you had a situation where Del Toro of the EPA broke protocol, the memo didn't go through the vetting procedure as it should have, and so they characterized Del Toro as a, quote, a rogue employee, downplayed the significance of the memo and said that there's no problem. So it was really a he said, she said story at that point, which then how do you get beyond that, which is when we came up with the idea of conducting our own tests. And that involved collaboration with Mark Edwards and his team at Virginia Tech. He got a emergency grant from the National Science Foundation to pay to send 300 test kits to Flint. And I worked with the residents there to coordinate and conduct this unprecedented, independent, citizen-led testing of the water in the city.
300 kits.
300 kits were sent.
And you've got an enormous level of actual participation. You know, you do this kind of thing and, you know, sometimes you get 50 or 100 people to do it. 277.
Yes. Edwards, when he applied for his NSF grant, said we're going to send 300 kits there and we're going to budget to get 75 returned. And he thought, based on past experiences, that's what could be expected. But the residents were so driven to get to the truth and to really do this in as thorough and comprehensive a way as possible, because we knew that they were going to try to attack us no matter what. Our determination was to not give them any legitimate openings, no chinks in the armor.
On this point, I think this is so important and frankly, a fascinating part of this story, because if you think about this part of the process here, the people of Flint know there's something wrong. They've been told to relax. They've been told things are fine. And what Kurt is talking about is not just sort of insulating yourself against criticism, but also realizing that people were going to say, this isn't a real journalist. This man works for the ACLU now. And you knew people were going to say they couldn't trust you. And here's what you told, or at least as reported by the Columbia Journalism Review, and I'll read this quote, and Kurt can tell us more about this. Quote, I was really walking a line in my own role as a journalist and activist. I'm not just observing the story, I'm participating in it. In my mind, I'm just trying to get to the truth. End quote. The ACLU is an advocacy group, of course. This is what CJR says, and Guyette's role has prompted some familiar skepticism about advocacy journalism. A June email between city officials discussing an interview request by Guyette, obtained via a FOIA request, describes him as, quote, one of the co-producers of the short film on the water crisis, which somewhat discredits his objectivity. So, Kurt, you knew they were going to say, you're not a real journalist. You're an advocate. You're with the ACLU. You were a journalist for decades, but now you're with the ACLU. What was your plan to make sure that didn't stick?
Bringing to the job the mindset of a journalist. My job title is an investigative reporter. I still consider myself a journalist, whether other people do or not. That's kind of irrelevant. But knowing that there is going to be this heightened skepticism, because you don't want to make mistakes. Because every time there's a mistake, that's used to discredit you. And if you make too many mistakes, you have no credibility whatsoever. And if you have no credibility, then you're worthless as a journalist.
But you really had to be right here, didn't you?
We couldn't make mistakes. But it was not really me as much as my thinking was the whole project. I didn't want them to discredit. You know, they might try to discredit me in terms of working for the ACLU, but it was more trying to discredit our tests. That was my biggest concern.
Next, we finally had the chance to sit down with billionaire entrepreneur and philanthropist Tom Golisano.
It's an interview that I'd been hoping to land for the past 2 years on the show, but Tom, as you might know, lives in Florida now. He made time to come in this week to coincide with a new documentary from WXXI all about Tom Golisano's legacy of charitable giving, and I hope you had a chance to see it. There is no question he has made a remarkable impact in our community. But for our interview, he insisted we could talk about anything, and he seemed eager to engage on politics, just as he did for years when he was running for governor and founding the New York State Independence Party. So here's Tom Golisano responding to a listener question. They wanted to know whom he's supporting for president.
Does it matter much? Because I'm just one individual.
You are just one. Well, you don't have to. I'll ask you. You don't have to answer. Who are you supporting for president?
Donald Trump.
Okay. Was that an easy decision for you or a difficult one?
It took a little time.
Any concern about his remarks about women over the years?
I think the media has done a terrible job of overinflating the negativism about them. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
Okay. And remember the comment about punishing women that have abortions?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody made a big deal out of that. I saw the entire interview. And what he said to begin the interview was, if Congress and the president signed legislation to make abortion illegal, would you punish women
would
for having
it? Would you criminalize it? Should there be criminal penalties for the woman who has it?
Yeah,
yes.
That's the answer. And, of course, he said, yes, there should be. But he based his answer on the fact that it was illegal and Congress had made it illegal.
I still think there's some baloney there, Tom. Because
I don't think there is.
Because right now, the pro-life position, the so-called pro-life position from Ted Cruz and many others is Congress should make it illegal and the penalty should be for the provider, not the woman. The woman is one of the victims in that cycle.
I disagree. I think if it was illegal, I think the woman's just as guilty as the doctor.
Okay. And you know what? I actually think that's an intellectually consistent position. And I think that has been something that people have wrestled with since Donald Trump made that comment. So that's fair enough. Let me give you another example.
Sure.
In his book, The Art of the Comeback, he said women who are employees who have children can never be fully loyal. And he gave kind of an arbitrary number. He said they're only 86% loyal to the company and they're always 14% thinking about their kids and they're not loyal employees.
Well,
Do you have a problem with that?
Let me ask you a question, Evan. Let's assume you had a company and you had 100 female employees.
Yeah.
And 100 male employees. Do you think the women will have more issues relative to family than the men will? And it will somewhat affect their work area.
Maybe marginally so.
That's all he's saying.
Just based on biology.
It's not just biology.
Tom, nobody ever says to me, I've got a four-year-old at home. There are days where I've got to cut out of work early, and nobody ever blinks an eye that Evan's got to go home and grab his son, and my wife works, she owns her own business. And nobody ever gives me grief about that. Women get the grief about it, and I know they carry the child.
What do you usually do between 4 and 5?
4 and 5 p.m.?
Yeah.
Well, I'm either working here or I'm home with my son.
But is it a level of work that's very immediate, that you have to accomplish something right away, like being on the air?
Well, not at 4 o'clock.
No. Okay. So you have a little bit of latitude. But if you're on an assembly line or taking customer service calls at 4 o'clock, it's a little tougher if you just want to leave.
Okay. Well, all right. So we've cleared up your positions there. Last thing on money and politics, one of our listeners wanted to know.
By the way, Paychex has over 55% of their employees are female, and they're great. Over 50% of our salespeople are female at Paychex.
Do they get paid leave?
No.
Okay. Should they get paid leave?
In my opinion, if they want to pay for it themselves.
Okay.
Which is what Cuomo actually put together. It's an employee deducted.
It's a mandatory employee contribution. Yeah. I think it's $1 a week. Yeah. And then you still only get 2/3 pay. You're not getting full pay.
Correct.
Right.
You can hear the full hour with Tom Golisano on our Connections podcast page. That's WXXINews.org/connections. Next up, let's turn to an issue that has sparked a lot of passion in the Finger Lakes. Garbage.
And we're not talking about litter. We're talking about landfills. Two of the largest landfills in New York State are already in the Finger Lakes region. And now there's a new proposal for New York City to start sending 1/4 of its trash to the Finger Lakes by rail. The deal would be for 20 years, and it would vastly expand the Seneca Meadows dump in Seneca Falls.
We talked to Hobart Professor Darren McGee and Doug Knipple of the Finger Lakes Zero Waste Coalition, who says the Finger Lakes is becoming New York City's dumping ground.
The initial attraction to form these relationships with private dump operators was money. There's no question about it. These local politicians just found it very difficult to resist the easy money. Ontario County gets a couple $1 million a year from landfill revenues, which amounts to 2 to 3% of the total county budget. What they do with that money is very interesting. Not one penny of it goes towards waste reduction or solid waste planning in Ontario County. It all is devoted to pet capital projects. So I think that money is a very big factor. Garbage is like water. It follows the path of least resistance. And the Finger Lakes has become, in a way, a sacrifice zone for municipalities throughout the Northeast that send their garbage to us.
Next, we discuss zombie properties in Rochester. You've probably seen them, boarded up homes, sometimes in the middle of otherwise thriving neighborhoods.
There's a local group called Take Back the Land. 2 weeks ago, we had Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren on the show, and they were listening. They heard the mayor defend Assemblyman David Gant, who owned a rental property but walked away from it, effectively turning it into a zombie property. Here's what they say about the city's stance on zombie properties.
I was actually shocked that response is so much not about what the needs of our city is at this point. And so let me point out some statistics. 75% of all foreclosed homes in the city are investor-owned homes, as this was. And almost 1/3 of investor-owned homes are vacant. So Mr. Gant's home, vacant home, is only one of many. And to say that this is okay as a business decision is saying that all of those vacant investor homes are really just business decisions. And that's not what our city needs right now. We need to make decisions based on the needs of our community, not the individual investor.
Julie, the mayor is saying he does have a right as a business owner to do that. He didn't break a law. He didn't do anything technically wrong. What would you have wanted her to say?
I would want her to say that he needs to take responsibility for anything that concerns the health of our neighborhoods. And he clearly did not do that. If there were things he could have done earlier on, he made decisions to allow that house to be empty, to not have anybody living in it. One of the suggestions that Empire Justice has made in their report, Eye in the Storm, is that the best way to prevent houses from going down is to keep them occupied. And he chose not to do that. And by doing that, he needed to make repairs on his home. He chose not to make repairs on his home by allowing it to be empty. They probably had copper stolen. It became a place that was unfixable. He made choices along the way that were bad choices.
Now, I certainly can't speak for him. If I recall correctly, he made it clear that he didn't just walk away for no reason, that he had tried, that he had done his best. So if he's saying, I've tried to get it rented, I didn't want it to go in that direction, but I had to walk away, I had no other alternative, what should he have done? Should he have made it offered to people who needed housing for free or for a very low rate? Or, you know, he may have said, I can't afford to do that. What would you say, Julie?
He could have donated it to a community land trust, and the house therefore could have been fixed up and could be used by someone we have many homeless people in this city. It could be a housing first house where someone who needs a home would have someplace to stay. There are a lot of uses that could have been made. Instead, the house ended up being torn down by the city at a cost of over $20,000.
Let's end the week with a drink.
Always a good idea.
The Rochester Cocktail Revival is coming. It's a series of events celebrating craft cocktails. We welcomed a group of restaurant owners and bartenders to talk about how Rochester is earning recognition across the country as a cocktail city.
A product that probably a lot of listeners are familiar with, Saint Germain. It's a popular elderflower liqueur. Unfortunately, the creator of that liqueur passed away yesterday. And what that I remembered thinking about that was in 2007 that liqueur came on the market. My team and I opened Good Luck in 2008, and I remember you went from knowing about a product that it seemed like cool people were using, Saint Germain, when we made the menu, and chasing it down. And that's how cocktail scene used to be. Like, you see someone else doing it, oh, I want to do that too. And so the point is that the inspiration is published before you are putting it into action. And now, as we've gotten this group of talented people here that are like pushing this cultural scene forward, it seems very much like the polarity has shifted, where we're doing the cool things, and instead of seeing it in print as inspiration, we see it later as validation. New York Times just put in their food section two articles. One was about split-based cocktails. Split-based cocktails, when you take two primary spirits and you make a cocktail from that. So if you like your Manhattan and you like a rye Manhattan, well, maybe a split base example would be splitting the proportion or the volume of rye that it originally called for half and half with scotch, for example. And then voila, you get a cool new drink. Rochester Bar has been doing that for years. Another thing that just appeared in print was the new embrace of aperitivos and bitter liqueurs. I don't know. Zach Makita is sitting to my right. I think he knows what Fernet Branca is. Like, we've been, as a scene, we're pushing the curve just as much as any market is. And now when we look in the magazines, we're not getting inspiration of, like, what should we buy and what should we put on our bars. We're seeing, like, oh, cool, we're doing that. It's validation instead of inspiration, which is pretty cool.
The Rochester Cocktail Revival runs from May 9th through the 15th.
We also want to mention that we are proud of our colleagues Veronica Volk from here at WXXI and Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle. They've been working for the last year on a brand new podcast, and finally it launches on Sunday. You will have a chance, if you haven't heard it by then, to hear the full first episode on Monday in our first hour on Connections. It's called Finding Tammy Joe, and you might have seen the promotions for it or heard about this. It is a remarkable piece of work in which they have been following the story of not only the murder of this 15-year-old girl, but the mystery for decades around who she is and what happened to her. And they're going to lay out this podcast. It launches on Sunday. It's going to be a weekly style. I was going to say Serial style. I don't want people to think they're ripping off Serial. They're certainly not. But if you liked Serial, you are going to love this. And so that's on Sunday. Hope you subscribe to that podcast and join them on the program on Monday afternoon. Okay, that's it for this edition of Weekend Connections. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio WEOS 89.5 FM.
And you can always hear us on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan, and we'll talk with you on Monday.